the abstracted sentence and the sense of abstraction. The models to which Jameson refers have immediate impact where images of the bodies are concerned. The Cartesian body and mind split is, indeed, the most prevailing model within the social sciences. In accordance with the separation of body and mind, the senses have also been modeled, and the body has become a site for ambiguity. On the one hand, the degree in modulation of the senses is dependent on views of scientific observation. The senses are, for instance, more or less reliable instruments of observation, depending on the nature of scientific models. One example is the battle between Goethe and Newton in the observation of colors. In Goethe's view, the color white consisted of a perceptible radiation of light, while Newton considered white to be a composition of spectral pure colors. In Goethe's view, observation of the external world emanated from the senses. In Newton's view, however, technical reproduction of color white seemed to prove that perception of light by the body had nothing to do with the external qualities of colors. In later theories, for instance in the work of Piaget, on the might of the sensorial perception, these senses became increasingly suspect as a means for everyday observation, and the strong separation between fantasy, hallucination and reality, which has dominated the 20th century, further reduced the signification of sensorious perception. On the other hand, the modulation of the senses is dependent upon ruling beliefs concerning the language process. Two modeling images regarding the relation between the senses and language seem to be interchanging continuously over time. One image consists of the unity of the sensorium. This unity model has been, for instance, described by Herder already in 1744. And upholds that the senses are internally interconnected. Human beings observe with this unity of the sensorium, but such observation is so bright that only hearing is suitable to convey the language process. Rousseau holds a similar view, but rather believes that language is so inferior that we need only one of our senses to apply it. The second image has been growing along the lines of increased beliefs in rationality and objectivity. In this model, the senses are separated, and their function is described according to the role within language communication. This functionalism developed in the early decades of the 20th century. It conveys that language process is an external influence, and that the senses are an empty space in which perception is determined from the outside. The model can be traced in theories of general linguistics, especially Ferdinand de Saussure, or objective epistemology, like Karl Popper, the psychoanalysis of Freud and Jung, and partly in theories of perception, Maurice Merleau-Ponty. On the surface, it seems that the second model has replaced all previous images concerning the unity of the sensorium. Merleau-Ponty observes, "The unity of the senses, which was regarded as an a priori truth, is no longer anything but a formal expression of a fundamental contingency. the fact that we are in this world. However, this is not the case. The images concerning the unity of the sensorium usually reappear as a critique on scientific ideas. In the more artistic genres from the early 20th century, it can be seen, for instance, in the work of Kandinsky and many others, ironically, mostly abstract artists. Where conception of illness and health are concerned, it reappears in the healing practices of alternative medicine and theory. Usually, at the point where traditional biological approaches fail to cure. Both type of critique claim the unity of the sensorium is an a priori truth for a damn good reason, which is that the bodies are always individual bodies, albeit shattered by separating discourses. Though in general the unity of the sensorium maintains a space for internal impulses, the separation of the senses seem to have resulted in abolishing the internal world. Even though literature in the 20th century seemed to maintain a general separation of impulses as eternal and external stimuli, both types of stimuli have little to do with individual perception. Internal stimuli, which are viewed as coming from a rather biological, physical makeup of the body, escape individual will and are therefore more circumstantial than internal. Internal impulses, viewed as psychological processes through Lacan, Freud, and also Fogg, still remain the product of associative processes resulting from external stimuli. How individual deals with these impulses is determined by a reaction rather than an individual action. Both internal and external stimuli present an external world view. This external model, too, I argue, leaves very little space for individual perception and expression, as it is dominated by the idea that perceptions of the individual body are either biologically determined, as essentialist theories imply, or culturally determined, as constructivist theories imply. In the end, there seems to be very little left for individuals to be, other than an ambiguous linguistic species. Merleau-Ponty, famous phenomenology of perception, takes a critical stance toward both positions concerning exclusive internal or exclusive external stimuli. In his work, these stimuli are presented as associationists or intellectual theories of perception. He nevertheless concludes, "Thought is no internal thing and does not exist independently of the world and of words. What misleads us in this connection and causes us to believe in thought which exists for itself prior to expression is that thought already constituted and expressed, which we silently recall to ourselves, and through which we acquire the illusion of an inner life." Maurice Merleau-Ponty could have said it like this, because this is how it sounds. "Thought is an internal thing, and it does not independently exist of the world and the words. What misleads us in this connection and causes us to believe in a thought which exists for itself prior to expression is the thought already constituted and expressed by we silently recall to ourselves and through which we acquire the illusion of an inner life." Yet Merleau-Ponty overlooks the possibility that thought as an internal thing does not exist, not because it does not, but because it does not do so in contemporary science. Indeed, a theory of the body is already a theory of perception, and Merleau-Ponty's own theory is no exception in spite of his jubilee. If we look at how individual sensing is viewed in social sciences, we see it is among the most poorly observed and far most reduced phenomena. Even within the labels of the body for itself, the body in itself, the seeing body or the seen body, the body as proposed I, thy, or it, the labels never extend the scope of an external world of phenomena. It could not be otherwise as long as the body is presented as an organism a priori, while the individual body is presented as a thing a posteriori. The model of separated senses is indeed much more suitable to present the generalized body as a priori than the former unity of the sensorium used to be. In fact, separating the senses separates the body from its individuality, while simultaneously deluding us in believing that we are dealing with a living body instead of a dead individual corpse. So too, it is possible to separate the senses in what is shared common sense and in what is individual, but only the general senses hold an authority for sciences. In the natural sciences too, the medical established body has biologically determined the senses. They have been reduced to 5 types: smelling, hearing, seeing, touching, and tasting. There is little space left over for anything else, a dustpan called the sixth sense, which generally holds the position of an unscientific category not worth mentioning. The irony, of course, is that, basically, the 5 Western senses do not differ from the ones which are proposed in the Bible as those with which one can do evil things and that need to be absoluted before dying. They are, in fact, metaphysical categories with religious connotations. Maybe as a result from the fact that within the Western religion one can do evil with the senses, they also hold an inferior status within the system of individual action, as well as in the natural sciences. As a result, the apparatus of the senses in fact exists only insofar as the externally created world allows it to be measured as a multiplication of its quality. The senses then are derived from externally created world, but not abstracted from the individual body perception. They are generalized. It is hardly miraculous that this external world of phenomena is so important to science, and most particularly the science of rationality. And emanating from this, with Merleau-Ponty, we might conclude that there is nothing more than an external world that defines all that live in it, and that the definition of an individual body is a futile undertaker, or maybe even something for the undertaker. Indeed, the body becomes a corpse, and anatomy becomes a science. It is quite obvious, however, that a dead body does not sense. If it did, our burial methods would be quite appalling. What is pluralized here, the magic word in science, from the specific to the general, and from the general to the specific, is the very questionable pluralization. It is also a convenient pluralization, which enables categories of productively, between brackets, healthy individuals fit to perform the task of a post-industrial society, and the, between brackets, handicapped individuals who are categorized as the burdens of that same post-industrial society. For instance, if Western society would be less visually dominated as it is, a blind person would stop being blind and would become everything he is instead of what he lacks. He's a sharp feeler, would be the category. Blind persons pluralize their senses all the time, but usually only blind persons are aware of this. Most seeing people look upon them as handicapped. Therein lays the biggest mischief of Western science. The categories which Western science establishes have far-reaching effects on society. They establish those who fall into the generalized law and those who are abnormal, who have therefore a hard time finding jobs, being allowed self-reliant and independent as others, and all this because the senses are being generated from a method based on an external world of phenomena. This in spite of the fact that even children cannot learn a language without conceptualizing words through body experiences involving all their senses, that is, the established one, as well as the ones we do not scientifically measure, like, for instance, a sixth sense. Again, a scientific measurement of the senses seems either biological or linguistic. The external worldview, with its separated senses, holds a strong grip on the ambiguous position of the body, as well as on the capacity of individuals to abstract from their intimate body experience a language which is less ambiguous than that of a general body discourse. For biological explanations about the senses, it is clear that the level of abstraction has materialized in the anatomy of the body. The senses, when approached from a linguistic point of view, are absolutely inferior to language. Abstraction, for example, is viewed as something that solely belongs to the capacity of spoken or written language. Nonverbal communication supposedly needs to be completed and complemented by verbal abstraction. Sign language, as spoken among deaf people, is supposedly limited, as if it has no capacity for scientific abstraction. Film documentaries, supposed to have no scientific value because they cannot generate scientific concepts without a verbal narrative, a voiceover, attached accompanying the images, and even then their scientific value is disputed. In fact, the social scientific claim holds that without the spoken or written language, there is no abstraction. Between the body experience and abstraction, there seems no link but that of an external world. I wonder if scientists who conserve such a view have ever observed their own children. One good reason to defend the external worldview is even more ironic. What is presented as an inner worldview usually neither has anything to do with individual bodies. A closer look at explanations pertaining the inner world as individually caused usually reveal a belief that the experiences of the body can be fully controlled by the mind. Such explanations appear with every unexplained new disease that befalls the faith of mankind. Cancer, for instance, has been one of those diseases that were believed to be the result of a psychological mental attitude. But also AIDS has been for some time viewed as the result of a mother complex. Here, what usually is presented as an internal world is mostly an infernal judgment. Although many of such ideas are catalogued as unscientific, social science equally maintains such position. Psychoanalysis, especially in its view of projection and transference, could be called one of the more desperate disciplines of personalizing the external circumstances into individualized problems. For instance, when psychoanalysis is practiced on those people stemming from cultures which maintain an external metaphysical spiritual worldview, the effects are devastating. If external spirits are treated as internal thoughts by the psychoanalysts, a total inflation of personality as well as a rupture of social life will be the result. Whether it concerns the belief in psychosomatic causes of medical illnesses, or the expectations for spirits to be projections of personal thoughts, in all cases the individual body experience is subjected to a model of the mind. Similar as well, in all cases there is no real abstraction, there's merely generality. What then is abstraction? To answer that question is a temporal matter. It holds that abstraction functions in different ways at different historical periods. Abstraction in modern poetry is different from abstraction in Taoist text. Abstract painting is different from abstract photography. Abstraction in anthropology and other social science are generally called postmodern, or more eagerly called postmortem by defenders of modernism. One thing is clear. Abstractions do not live forever. At some point in time they become puzzles, which are so personal that generalizing them automatically implies extreme reduction and hollow representation. At that point, the livelihood of abstraction depends on whether it can be fitted into the genre. In that fact exactly lays the problem of abstraction. It is both spatial and therefore temporal, though not sequential in the evolutionistic sense of the word. Abstraction does nothing. Instead, it is an action being done by individuals who abstract from scientific, general laws, or religious assumptions, whatever they can use to complement their own private experience. Language has been defined over and over again throughout the history of linguistics in numerous general ways, but never as the capacity of individual human beings to abstract. In fact, the science of linguistics deplorably lacks understanding of private language, precisely because its fixation with evolution. All the big fights that have passed about the origin of language breathe the problem of evolutionism through the strong belief that generalization in the language process will be the ultimate and highest quality of human knowledge. What could be abstraction then? Well, why not extend our possibilities? Those we hold about symbolism and metaphors with abstraction as a vehicle for individual body experience in a metonymical sense. The end and the beginning of a pluralizing operation that holds nothing other than an impulse and cares little for generalization. And it might be a good idea for some time that we stop viewing the body as a means of expression and instead view expression as a means of the individual body. The abstracted sentence and the sense of abstraction.